Hello and welcome to our quarterly podcast discussing activities to support consistent application. And this podcast covers the quarter to June 2021. I'm Petrina Buchanan, a member of the ISB's technical staff, and I'm here today with Sue Lloyd, Vice Chair of the Board and Chair of the Interpretations Committee. So it's been a busy few months, there's a lot to cover, so I'm going to get straight into the detail. Now, following Interpretations Committee discussions in April and June and board discussions during Q2, the committee has actually published 5 final agenda decisions and 2 tentative agenda decisions. And the board also added 2 new narrow scope projects that came from the committee's work. So I'm going to start with the finalised agenda decisions. And just to be clear, the board discussed and did not object to any of these agenda decisions in accordance with the new due process step that involves the board in the finalisation of those agenda decisions. So the first agenda decision relates to cloud computing arrangements and specifically software as a service arrangements. The question the committee discussed asked about how the customer accounts for any costs of configuring or customising the supplier software. So the facts are such that the supplier controls the software, the customer has access to it, and to fully benefit from that access, there's some configuration or customisation that needs to be done. So I'll first just recap on what the committee said in the tentative agenda decision. So the committee dealt with 2 questions. The first was whether the configuration or customization gives rise to an intangible asset, to which the committee said, well, typically no. Ultimately, this depends on the nature of the configuration or customization performed. And in some cases, the customer may obtain an intangible asset, but often the configuration or customization is a service. The second question then asked how to account for that service. And the tentative agenda decision noted the applicable requirements in IAS 38 that says the customer accounts for the services when received, which is when they are performed by a supplier in accordance with a contract to deliver them. So to determine when to recognise the costs as an expense in P&L, the customer actually has to determine when the services are performed by the supplier in accordance with a contract to deliver them. So to identify whether there's one or more services, the customer would then look to the requirements in IFRS 15 on identifying performance obligations. If the configuration or customization is distinct from access to the supplier software, then the customer would recognize that service as an expense when the supplier performs it. But if the configuration or customization is not distinct, such that the supplier really provides an integrated service of access to configure or customize software, then the customer would recognize that service as an expense over the contract term as it receives access to the software. So having considered the comments received, Sue, did the committee actually make any changes to that tentative agenda decision?
They did, but I think really sort of refinements or tweaks rather than changes in what was in the tentative agenda decision. So a couple of things. The refinement was really to clarify what happens if a third party and not the SaaS supplier performs the configuration or customization. And in that case, the committee clarified that the customer would recognise the configuration or customization as an expense when that service is performed by the third party supplier. And it's important to distinguish, however, between a contract with a third party and a contract with the supplier that subcontracts a configuration or customization to a third party. The agenda decision distinguishes between those two sort of arrangements, so really look closely at the wording if a third party is involved in your arrangement.
Great, thank you. Now, so there are actually a couple of comments that came up in comment letters, and I was actually asked these questions at our conference in June, so I think listeners might be interested in these. So the first is the reference to IFRS 15 in the agenda decision. Why are we telling customers to look to IFRS 15, a standard that's really all about the supplier's accounting? Now, I know we covered this in a previous podcast, but I do think it's worth repeating.
Okay, so just to be clear, the agenda decision isn't saying that customers are sort of always required to look at IFRS 15, a revenue standard, to decide when to recognise expenses. But in this case, the agenda decision does refer to IFRS 15, even though we're talking about expenses. And it says to look there specifically to help in identifying whether there are one or more services. And that's really because of requirements in IAS 38. And those requirements say that to determine its accounting, the customer must determine when the supplier performs the service in accordance with the contract to deliver them. And so that really gives us the hook. And it's specifically because IAS 38 requires the customer to determine when the supplier has performed the service that the committee concluded that it was relevant when identifying the services performed that the customer look at the more specific requirements in IFRS 15 just for that very particular aspect of the accounting.
Okay, great. And the other comment I've actually heard is one about the accounting. So is the agenda decision saying that a customer always has to recognise these costs as an expense upfront? I mean, if that's the case, does that really provide useful information?
So the first point, I think, is to say that the committee isn't really asked to opine on whether they think the outcomes are sort of useful. That's something that the board looks at when it sets the requirements. And we ask the committee really to focus on what the standards say or require. We do give the committee a chance to make observations on the usefulness, particularly to share those observations with the board when they think it's necessary. But it isn't really the core of what the committee's discussions are about. But having said that, I'm happy to give you a few of my own thoughts on this. But let me first maybe explain what the agenda decision says, and perhaps just as importantly, what it doesn't say. So the agenda decision explains what IAS 38 requires a customer to do when it incurs costs on intangible items. So it first says, you know, has the customer received an intangible asset or a service? If there's an asset, then recognize it if the recognition criteria are met. If there's no asset, but the customer does receive a service, then recognize the cost of the service as an expense when the service is received. So 38 setting out a logical approach to the recognition of costs. The decision doesn't say it that all configuration or customization costs must be recognized as an expense upfront. Instead, it says if there's an intangible asset, recognize it if the relevant criteria in 38 are met. If there's no intangible asset, then recognize the cost as an expense when you receive the service, which is when the supplier performs. And the timing of that performance depends on the contract and the nature of the services that are being received. So those configuration or customization services may be received upfront, or they may be received over the contract term. So the agenda decision, rather than providing a specific answer for any cloud computing contract, sets out what I think are helpful guidance, explaining the applicable requirements, what you really need to think about, and what the conclusions applying those requirements will be, will depend on the nature. Having said all of that, we know that IAS 38 is showing its age a bit, getting quite a few questions about things that fall within its scope. And as part of the agenda consultation, we are asking people for their views on what you think the board should look at in the future of the next 5 years. And one topic that stakeholders might wish to get us to think about is assessing whether IAS 38 can cope with all of the different types of contracts linked to the digitalized world that are now coming within its scope, and, you know, suggestions on what that scope of work might be.
Great. Thank you, Sue. I realise we've spent quite some time on that cloud computing question, but we do know it matters. Entities are increasingly entering into these types of sort of cloud computing arrangements. And we're also aware that this agenda decision might actually result in some entities deciding that they need to change their accounting policy. I'll also just mention before moving on that there is actually a related agenda decision that was published back in March 2019. It's related because it's also in SaaS arrangements, but it deals with the fees that a customer pays to access the supplier software in the cloud.
Can I just add one other thing, Petrina?
Sure.
I think the other thing that's interesting about that agenda decision on the cloud computing arrangements is, while it's about cloud computing, hence its title, I think it's quite a useful one for walking through how you think about navigating the literature. So this sort of idea that IAS 38 can lead you to IFRS 15 to help you work out the accounting and how to navigate that sort of thinking is also in the agenda decision. So it's got some more sort of general helpful hints in there as well.
No, thank you, Sue. And really good to point that out, actually, because it is one, as you say, that if you really, I think, look carefully of almost if you walk through the agenda decision yourself and what it says. I think it is very helpfully walking through how to kind of, you know, take our big book of thousands of pages and work out, you know, work out how to account for transactions. Great. So moving on to IS2 and the measurement of inventories at net realizable value. So an agenda decision on this was published in June, and it really responds to a very specific question on the definition of net realizable value. So Sue, I'm going to hand over to you again on this.
Okay, so I'll start by explaining the question, which specifically asked about a part of the definition of net realizable value in IAS2, the inventory standard. And in that standard, net realizable value is defined as the estimated selling price, less the estimated cost of completion and the estimated costs necessary to make the sale. And the question the committee was received was about that last bit of the definition, the estimated costs necessary to make the sale. And when measuring net realizable value, does an entity include all costs necessary to make the sale, or only those that are incremental to the sale? So the agenda decision focuses on a very specific and actually quite a subtle point. It notes that IAS2 does not allow an entity to limit the costs included to only those that are incremental to the sale. If costs were limited in this way, an entity could potentially exclude costs that it must incur to sell the inventories, but that are not incremental to a particular sale. Now, that doesn't mean that the costs necessary to sell inventories are never limited to those that are incremental. That, depending on the inventories and the entity's business, the costs necessary to make the sale could include only those that are incremental. But what the agenda decision is saying is that an entity cannot limit the cost to only those that are incremental, so sort of knowingly exclude them if that would exclude costs necessary to make the sale. Now, the agenda decision does note that when an entity estimates those costs, it needs to use judgment, considering its specific facts and circumstances, including the nature of the inventories that are being measured. And some respondents to the tentative agenda decision asked the committee if they could go further and provide some more guidance, if you like, about the nature or types of costs that should be included in the measurement of net realizable value. But the agenda decision doesn't go on to address those issues, because that would have meant going beyond what's actually required in IAS2. And people might remember that agenda decisions cannot add to or change existing requirements.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Sue. Now, the remaining three agenda decisions published address topics that have more specialised application, let's say. So in the interest of time, we're not going to cover them in detail in this podcast. However, what I will try to do is give you enough information so that you can identify if these agenda decisions are likely to be relevant to you, so that you can then go to our website to get further information. So the first one I'm going to mention is an agenda decision on IAS 19 that deals with how to attribute retirement benefit to periods of employee service for a particular defined benefit plan. And what that agenda decision explains is when an entity recognises its obligation to provide the retirement benefit, and thus when it recognises an expense, when, first of all, employees receive a lump sum benefit only if they are still employed by the entity at a specified retirement age. Secondly, the benefit is capped at 16 years of service. And thirdly, the benefit is calculated using only the number of consecutive years of employee service immediately before retirement. So I'll just emphasize that is a particular defined benefit plan, but if those sort of facts sort of coincide with what are the facts in your defined benefit plan, then it's worth having a look. The next agenda decision that was also published in May is on inflation cash flow hedge accounting. Now, IFRS 9 includes a rebuttable presumption that non-contractually specified inflation risk is not separately identifiable and reliably measurable, and therefore applying IFRS 9, it cannot be designated as a risk component in an eligible hedging relationship. Now, that presumption can be rebutted, but the threshold's high. So the question addressed in this agenda decision is whether the presumption can be rebutted, and therefore cash flow hedge accounting and IFRS 9 applied, when an entity has a floating rate financial instrument reference to, say, LIBOR, and enters into an inflation swap that swaps the variable interest cash flows on that floating rate instrument for variable cash flows based on an inflation index. And in short, the answer is no. In that fact pattern, cash flow hedge accounting cannot be applied, and the agenda decision really explains in some detail the reasons why with reference to the applicable requirements in IFRS 9. Now, the final agenda decision published in Q2 relates to a couple of questions arising when an entity is no longer a going concern. The first question was whether an entity can prepare financial statements on a going concern basis for previous periods if it was a going concern in those previous periods, but it had not prepared financial statements for those periods. And on that question, the committee said no. If the entity is no longer a going concern, then it cannot prepare financial statements on a going concern basis. The second question was about whether an entity restates comparative information when it first prepares financial statements on a non-going concern basis. And for that question, answer wasn't actually provided in the agenda decision because research we conducted identified actually no diversity in application, so there was no evidence the question had widespread effect. So that was the finalised agenda decision. We're going to move on now to the tentative agenda decisions, and there are currently two of those out for comment. So the first tentative agenda decision addresses a question about the definition of a lease. A submission asked whether a particular contract to fix the price of electricity produced by a wind farm conveys the right to obtain the economic benefits from use of that wind farm. And of course, that the right to obtain the economic benefits from use is one part of the definition of a lease in IFRS 16. Now, before getting into the detail, I think it's important just to note that the committee's discussions really focused only in that question asked. There are actually other questions that might arise for this fact pattern. So for example, there could be a question about whether the electricity purchaser controls the wind farm. But the committee focused only in that question about the definition of a lease. So now to explain the fact pattern, maybe picture an electricity market where all suppliers of electricity sell the electricity that they produce to a market grid, and all purchasers of electricity buy their electricity from that grid. And then you've got an market operator that determines the spot price for the electricity bought and sold. So in this fact pattern, a wind farm sells electricity it produces to the grid, and the customer purchases electricity from the grid. But in addition to that, the electricity customer enters into a contract with the wind farm to fix the price of a volume of electricity that equals the volume of electricity the wind farm is going to produce over a 20-year period. So in effect, this contract means that overall, the wind farm supplier receives a fixed price for the electricity it supplies to the grid over the contract term, and the customer pays a fixed price. And both parties really achieve this by settling net and cash the difference between the fixed price and the spot price for that volume of electricity. And this particular contract also transfers to the customer all renewable energy credits that accrue from use of the wind farm. So in this question, the committee actually concluded that the contract does not contain a lease. And that's because the contract does not give the customer the right to obtain substantially all the economic benefits from use of the wind farm, which is required by paragraph B9A of IFRS 16 for there to be a lease. Why was that? It's really because the contract gives rise to neither the right nor the obligation for the customer to obtain any of the electricity the wind farm produces. So in the example, electricity is the primary output of the wind farm. So electricity is really the main economic benefit derived from use of the wind farm. And without any right or obligation to purchase electricity, the customer doesn't have the right to obtain substantially all the economic benefits from use. Now, the second submission, the second tentative agenda decision, included really a series of questions about TLTRO3 transactions. Now, those transactions involve loans given to banks by the European Central Bank, where the amount borrowed and the rate paid is linked to the volume and amount of loans that the bank then makes to non-financial corporations and households. So Sue, because this is clearly about IFRS 9, I'm going to ask you to talk about it.
Excellent. Always happy to talk about IFRS 9. Now, before I start talking, though, I'm going to tell you that I'm not going to talk about TLTRO3 transactions. I'm going to call them these transactions for brevity, but I will talk about them. But that's shorthand. So this is a question about IFRS 9, but it's also a question that involves a standard we don't look at so often, the government grant standard IAS 20, and the interaction between those two standards, which can be tricky because it's quite an old standard and a new standard. And there's a question about whether these types of transactions represent loans with a below market interest rate. And if that's the case, so if you conclude that it's below market, and if the ECB is considered to be government, as it's defined in IAS 20, then the benefit of the below market interest rate is accounted for within the scope of IAS 20. Now, I've emphasised that the benefit of the below market rate is within the scope of IAS 20, if these transactions are considered to be a government loan and below market. It's not the whole loan that would be within the scope of IAS 20. And that's a really important point. The bank would continue to apply IFRS 9. So they'd initially recognise the loan at its fair value, applying IFRS 9 and then account for it within IFRS 9. And it's only the below market piece determined in accordance with IAS 20 as the difference between the initial measurement of the loan applying IFRS 9 and the proceeds received, if any. That difference, if any, would be accounted for applying IAS 20 if it's determined that these loans are provided at off-market interest rates from a government.
Great, thanks, Sue. Now, on this one, the committee didn't actually opine or conclude on whether a bank applies IAS 20 to any part of these transactions. Why was that?
Well, as I mentioned, these transactions would contain a government grant within the scope of IAS 20 only if three factors exist. Firstly, you have to conclude that the interest rate charged is a below market rate. The European Central Bank needs to meet the definition of government in IAS 20. And the transaction with the ECB needs to be distinguishable from the borrowing bank's normal trading transaction. So you need to be able to sort of see this transaction. Now, to make all of those three determinations requires judgment and depends on the specific facts and circumstances, which isn't really the committee's role. We sort of talk about what needs to be determined rather than, you know, making the judgments that are required to apply the principles and the standard.
Great, thank you. That was definitely an important one to clarify. Another important aspect, I think, of the committee's discussion on this that I think you touched on, but maybe you could elaborate on, is the fact that the loan is actually a financial liability and therefore within the scope of IFRS 9. So maybe you could just talk a bit more about that.
Yes, yeah, so maybe it seems obvious, but I think that the tentative agenda decision importantly includes a reminder that a bank receiving one of these loans from the ECB starts off in IFRS 9. They've got a loan that they've received that clearly meets the definition of a financial liability within the scope of IFRS 9. So that's where the bank has to go first in working out how to account for the loan. IFRS 9 then tells the bank how to initially recognise a loan, what to do if the fair value of the loan differs from the transaction price, and when, for example, to account for the loan entirely within IFRS 9. So, for example, it's not the case that an entity automatically looks to other standards if the fair value of the loan differs from the transaction price, but you only do that if the consideration received is identified as being for something other than the loan. Now, I could talk all day about this topic. You know, I love IFRS 9. And if you're a bank receiving this type of funding from the ECB, I'd really encourage you to read the tentative agenda decision and to think about commenting on it. It includes a discussion about the initial and subsequent measurement in IFRS 9, as well as applicable disclosure requirements. It also notes that a couple of the aspects of the accounting for these transactions that the committee looked at, they're really recommending be considered by the board as part of the post-implementation review on the classification and measurement requirements in IFRS 9, which we're planning to publish the request for information on shortly. And these were the aspects relating to how to determine the effective interest rate on initial recognition and how to subsequently measure the loan when estimated cash flows might arise as a result of a contingency. So specifically, how do you think about the conditions attached to the loan and whether the bank will satisfy those conditions, and how do you go about determining the effective interest rate in those circumstances? So I'd say that the tentative agenda decision doesn't answer every question that arises when you're accounting for this type of central bank funding, but it does helpfully set out how you should go about thinking about what standards to apply and what needs to be considered. So what questions you need to answer, what order, and what the applicable requirements are to refer to. But we'll certainly be really interested in the comment letters we get on this tentative agenda decision.
Yes, and I'll just repeat, by the way, that we certainly welcome comments on both of these tentative agenda decisions we've just talked about. So both the, I will mention it, TLTRO3 transactions and also the electricity wind farm contract. And the comment period for both of those remains open until the 16th of August. So that was really sort of the committee meetings covered. As I said at the start, the board actually just in June decided to add two new narrow scope projects on topics that actually were recently discussed and considered by the committee. And those topics are supply chain finance arrangements and the classification of liabilities with covenants. Now, both topics have proven to be of great interest to our stakeholders, so I think it's important that we give you some detail on what the board decided. So I'm going to start with supply chain finance, or what we're actually now referring to as supplier finance arrangements. Now, regular listeners will be aware that the committee published an agenda decision on this topic back in December 2020. And that agenda decision explains the existing requirements and IFRS standards applicable to these supplier finance arrangements. And it really walks through what entities are already required to consider when presenting liabilities subject to these arrangements on the balance sheet, when presenting cash flows, and when providing disclosures. And the work that we did to support the committee's analysis there really prompted a lot of stakeholder input. Stakeholders wanted to engage with us on the topic, and especially the investor community. So you may be aware that the original submission to the committee came from the rating agency Moody's, and really investors from all backgrounds were keen to then give us their views. And actually on this one, we were also fortunate to be able to speak to a number of the financial institutions that actually provide the finance in these arrangements. So that was really very helpful in trying to be able to assess what information is available or could be made available to entities in this. So really from all of that input then received, we worked out that by asking entities to provide relatively few additional specific pieces of information, then we would hope that investor information needs could be met. So the board will propose that entities provide information about the main terms and conditions of these arrangements, as well as quantitative information about the amount of payables that are part of the arrangements, the amount of payables that are now owed to the bank or the financial institution because suppliers have already been paid, and also payment terms for those payables.
Katrina, maybe I'll add a few comments if I could on the supplier finance. I think the first one is to say that just because the board is adding this topic to the work plan, it doesn't mean either that we don't already have requirements or that you should ignore the agenda decision. In fact, it's the opposite. The research that supported the board's decision to add a standard-setting project highlighted the importance for investors of entities providing information about these types of arrangements in their financial statements. And there are already requirements that apply to those arrangements. So it's really important for entities that have these supply finance type arrangements in place to look closely at the agenda decision that was published in December, particularly when working out what the best balance sheet presentation is and how best to provide information about liquidity risks. I think if existing requirements are applied well, many of the investor needs we're hearing about could be met. And the second is that this is really of a lot of interest to investors. And at the board discussion, I actually expressed some regret at the fact that by adding this project, it seems to suggest that we need to write explicit requirements every time we need transparency about a particular transaction or arrangement. And we've already got overarching requirements in IAS 1 and IFRS 7 for this purpose. And I worry a little bit that it undermines the effectiveness of the sort of principle-based nature of those requirements if we keep adding specific requirements for these specific types of transactions. Having said that, I did vote in favour of this project because of the extensive support from investors, and also because there's some very specific quantitative information that investors are interested in that I think is difficult to be sure they will receive unless we introduce some specific requirements.
Great, thank you. So finally, we're going to move on to the classification of liabilities as current or non-current, and specifically in this case, how to classify loans when there are covenants to be met within 12 months of the reporting date. Now, listeners will remember that the committee discussed this topic at its December meeting and published a tentative agenda decision, setting out how to apply amendments issued by the board in January 2020 to three fact patterns that involved loans with covenants to be met within 12 months of the reporting date. Now, that tentative agenda decision prompted a lot of comments. We actually received 36 comment letters, which is, as far as I can remember, is a record for tentative agenda decisions. And the committee discussed those comments in April. Now, whilst most respondents actually agreed or didn't disagree with the analysis and conclusions in the tentative agenda decision, and in fact, when it discussed, the committee members unanimously agreed with the conclusions set out in the tentative agenda decision for those three fact patterns. So no real disagreement with what the tentative agenda decision said when it set out sort of how to apply those 2020 amendments. However, almost all respondents also commented on the outcomes and consequences of applying those amendments. And that feedback actually included some new information, for example, particularly in relation to seasonal businesses that had not been provided to or considered by the board when it had developed the 2020 amendments. So having received that feedback, the committee decided not to finalise the agenda decision and instead to report all the feedback to the board so that the board could then consider it. So the board has now added a new project on the classification of liabilities, having considered that feedback. So maybe you could walk us through that.
Sure. So this is a tricky issue, but one that's really important. And I guess some people might be surprised that we're looking at this sort of issue again so soon after finalising the amendments. And I think the first thing to say is that the committee's process has been really helpful to surface some issues that need to be looked at within a fairly short time frame. So having been informed that there were application questions coming from the 2020 amendments, the committee's discussions on the topic and the tentative agenda decision meant that we got new information that we weren't aware of before. And this is a really tricky area of financial reporting, and it's really because the classification is firstly, important piece of information, whether something's current or non-current, and it's, you know, to state the obvious, very binary. So all liabilities have to either be classified as either repayable within 12 months or repayable after 12 months. And for many liabilities, that's a really straightforward question. But when there are covenants that need to be met within the next 12 months that could make the loan repayable on demand if they're not met, then it's trickier to know what the answer should be, because there's no way of knowing for sure whether the loan will become repayable within the next 12 months. And if we classify the loans with covenants as non-current, then that ignores the future covenants and assumes everything will be fine, when in fact the loan could become repayable within a few weeks or months. And if we say that the loans are current, we imply that the entity has already failed to meet the future covenants, when there may actually be no actual default at the reporting date and everything might actually be fine when the covenant gets tested in the next 12 months. So trying to deal with that sort of conditionality within a binary classification model is difficult. And really the takeaway is that this sort of current, non-current classification in itself can't give investors the full picture when there's this sort of uncertainty about whether a loan will become due in these circumstances. So when the board developed the 2020 amendments, we didn't want to base the analysis on future expectations. And the board said it would be wrong to just ignore the fact that there are future covenants that need to be tested within the 12 months. And to classify such loans as non-current could be misleading for investors, especially if things aren't looking great in terms of the likelihood of those covenants being met as at the reporting date. But at the same time, the board acknowledged that classifying all loans with covenants as current just because of the existence of future covenants wouldn't be particularly useful either. So we developed requirements basing the classification on the circumstances at the reporting date. And if the entity met the future covenants at the reporting date, then the loan would be classified as non-current. If the entity didn't meet the covenants at the reporting date, then the loan would be classified as current. Feedback we've got through the committee's work is that that won't always produce the most helpful results. And in particular, people pointed out that for some seasonal businesses, it could result in loans flipping from current classification to non-current and back again without there really being any change in the underlying business. So in response to this feedback, the board's proposing to change the classification requirements in IAS 1 again and to add some new presentation and disclosure requirements. And this is a very narrow scope project and very targeted. It's only really targeted at loans that have got covenants that will be tested within 12 months of the reporting date. So the board will retain its view that the information about an entity's circumstances at the reporting date regarding covenants to be tested within 12 months is useful for investors. But instead of that sort of determining classification as current or non-current, instead the entity would be required to disclose that information. And the classification would be based on an entity's compliance with covenants tested as at or before the reporting date. And the information would entity would provide information about the covenants in the notes to the financial statements. In addition to that, the board will also propose that there be separate presentation in the balance sheet, a line item called something like non-current loans subject to covenants that would include any loans classified as non-current, but where the entity must actually comply with covenants within 12 months of the reporting date. Now, this issue has come to light particularly due to some recent amendments that are due to come into effect from the 1st of January 2023. So just to reassure people, the board is also proposing to move the effective date of those new amendments back by a year to 2024. So an important set of proposals to look out for.
Great. Thank you very much, Sue. And so for both of those new board projects, we expect the board to discuss due process steps in July and then move into drafting the respective exposure drafts. So I think you could expect both exposure drafts to be published for comment before the end of this year. So a lot we covered in this podcast that will now bring our podcast to a close.
Quite long.
I think we're going to put some handy hints on, you know, if you're interested in this topic, this is where you should listen to the tape.
Absolutely long, but we hope useful and interesting, especially if we can point you to the places that might be of more interest. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. As I said, hopefully you found it useful, and certainly please email communications@ifrs.org if you have any suggestions for improvement. So take care, thank you, and goodbye.